So this is the Living Legacy Project at the Birchfield Penny Arts Center, and it is November 12th, 2015, and I am here today with Mike Murarian. So Michael, thank you so much for coming in today.
Yeah, thank you.
It's a quiet, rainy day here at the Birchfield before our second Friday opening tomorrow night. So sort of the calm before the storm. So, Mike, you've lived in Buffalo for a number of years now.
Since 2008.
Okay.
So is that, how many years is that? I don't even know. Is that under seven?
That's about seven.
About seven.
9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. 7 years now.
2008 via Brooklyn.
Uh-huh. Came here from that. And we'll hopefully touch on that throughout the interview. But this is a very big, broad question, as many of them are. And
right.
So you can interpret it however you want. But what inspired you to want to be an artist?
I think everything always goes back to childhood,
yeah.
Your earliest, you know. And I was an only child. So
mm-hmm.
I think most only children, their first kind of radar goes to the arts because they're by themselves. They're, you know, trying to entertain themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So you end up drawing, you end up pretending, you know. So at one point I wanted to be a myriad of things. By the time I was in high school, I wanted to act, I wanted to draw. Matter of fact, when I got into college, I was debating whether to do an art major or a theater major. And of course, I picked the wrong one. Picked theater. We'll touch on that later. But you know, so it was, I think that was the initial genesis, just being by yourself as a little kid. You know, I had no brothers and sisters. And then beyond that, you know, when I was growing up in the 70s, there was a cool local, because I grew up in Massachusetts, there was a guy named Captain Bob. And he used to draw live, not live, but taped, every Saturday morning. So my parents would be asleep. I'd have to get up like really, you know, crack of ass. Like, it was on like 7 in the morning for some reason. So I would get up really early and he would be drawing like a snake in a tree, or he'd be drawing some like animal. And I would just draw along with it, you know. So that was kind of inspiring. I enjoyed that.
Was he similar or different than Bob Ross?
Yeah, he was like a Bob Ross,
yeah.
But he was a local WGBH television in Massachusetts had him on. And if you look, I think there's maybe one or two clips on YouTube and you hear his like heavy mass accent when he's talking about stuff. And it's very funny. But he was great, and I loved it, and I try to copy it and follow him, you know. And then, so I think that was that seed, you know, when I was a kid. And then I got more into theater later. But I think when I look back on my theater career, it totally feeds into the art.
Mm-hmm.
It's like my art is just basically a reflection of the theater. You know, I try to create a lot of, you know, the dramatics or comedy or horror or, you know, pathos or whatever.
Absolutely.
You know.
Your work has a lot of those.
Yeah.
Strong.
So kind of, okay, you can see the through line.
Yeah. Now, what inspired you? So that's, you know, your love of art and where that started. But then what inspired you to want to pursue that as a career?
Basically, it was the last thing I had not failed at. That's what it came down to. Because I said, you know what, I'm going to be, and I went to the theater. And, you know, I had, you know, I did art in, like, since I was in, up to college. Then I said, you know what, I looked at it this way. I can draw. You know, I've always drawn, and I was always really good at it. So I didn't feel I had to study it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but theater, I didn't know much about it. I liked to do it, you know, and I learned memorization and, you know, all the things that kind of, the way you take care of your body and the diaphragm, the way you speak, and just getting in front of public people and being able to emote and talk. And
mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, I always say to artists, take an acting class, because, you know, you see these poor guys, son of a bitches, they have to do these artist talks, and they get up there and they're just, and this is this, and this. What? What are you saying?
No eye contact.
No eye contact. They're scared to death.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? I think every artist should do an acting class. It really, it's great. You know, so anyway, I was looking at it that way. And from there on, you know, I wrote for a while. I was a playwright for years in New York City. I wrote screenplays. I worked in summer stock theater for years, and I wrote children's plays, and which is kind of funny because I use children a lot in my art now.
In a very different way.
In a different way. But you know what, though? The plays I used to write as a, you know, 20-something-year-old at this theater were, you know, I had a Winnie the Pooh story I wrote where Christopher Robbins gets shot at the end. There's a guy hunting Tigger the whole episode.
Mm-hmm.
And he shoots Christopher Robin by accident. He vows never to shoot, you know, hunt Tiggers ever again. And, you know, and when he leaves, you realize Christopher Robin had like a hubcap under his shirt and he wasn't really dead, you know. But you know, the parents are in horror when they see a, you know, lead character in a kids show get killed on stage. You know, they freak out. And I remember the producers going, "Mike, what are you doing?" You know. But I got sidetracked there. Oh, but you know, so I wrote for the theater. I directed. I wrote in New York City. I wrote plays. I got a horrible review from Variety when I had a play open in Los Angeles. My agent dumped me at one point, and it just everything I tried to do in the theater, it just never kind of went anywhere, you know. And I just didn't have the stamina. I didn't have the thick skin to take rejection and this and that. So finally, around the year, I was a late bloomer. Around 2005, I started saying, you know what? I've done every other creative thing I've wanted to do and really never got anywhere. I'm gonna try the art world now because that's all I have left. And it kind of worked out. You know, lately it's been in a bit of a lull. I've had some problems, but that's the nature of the art world and you know, any career-based thing. It's, you know, there are ups and downs, you know. But it started out gangbusters, you know, and I said, you know what, I guess I'll ride this wave for a while, see what happens, you know.
Well, your work is both really sumptuous and fun to look at, and also like dark and fascinating, and there's just so many layers you could pick apart with it. And you
Thank
know,
you.
I like a lot of the sort of tongue-in-cheek commentaries that you make very playfully, and but also with all, you know, with teeth and swirls and this sort of
Well, that's the
macabre.
yeah, that's the fun for me to do that, to say how can I make something entertaining to look at and maybe leave with a thought of like, oh, you know what? Like to me, well, I don't care if people like my art or hate it or whatever. I mean, I want them to like it. But sometimes I get just as much of a charge when somebody gets really mad at something. Or they say, you know, I went to a couple of openings and somebody gave me a, I think it was a compliment. They go, yeah, I went to your show and I guess it was good because I thought about it later. I was like, okay, I'll
I'll
take
take it. Yeah. Thank
that.
you.
You know, so if
And
I
it
can.
totally can, if your work does totally stick with you and it becomes very, you know, even after seeing just a few words, if you see others in different contexts, you're like, oh, it's that guy. You know, it's Mike doing these different things.
Yeah, well, it's funny you say that because I always think I change too much with my art, you know, and that's one of the problems I've had as an artist. Because I think, you know, at the end of the day, people are like, collectors are kind of like sheep, you know what I mean? They want to buy like things that they can put in a family room and, you know, and they respect and they love edgy art and they love all that stuff. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, a kid, you know, sporting a shotgun or something, a painting, you know, of that, they would maybe pass for like a beautiful woman painting, you know. So as of late, I've been trying to kind of get a little happier, I call it, and paint more kind of maybe more mainstream things, but still kind of keep a little edge there, you know, to test that out for a while.
Well, I think it's very interesting the relationship that has existed, you know, in the history of Western art with art as capitalism or art as commerce, you know, and just both the history of patronage and just the things that incredible artists made for their patrons. But at the same time, how, yeah, you know, what you're experiencing with having to alter your vision a little bit because does it sell? You know,
Right,
and that
that's
sort
what
of
comes down.
and that and that's both, you know, in some ways from a purist standpoint is like problematic, but from a reality standpoint is just the way that it is. And you know, and it's awesome that you can move yourself in such a way to be able to support yourself on your art. And I think what you're able to do with supporting yourself, you know, I don't, maybe not in full, but to a degree with your art is something that a lot of artists are trying to navigate to get there.
Right. And you know, for me, you know, in the past, it's always, you know, I've grappled with this, and I'm lucky because, in a weird way, I am very lucky. I started my art career so late because I worked in an interior design firm for years, 13 years. So I learned a lot about graphics and how things, you know, look together color wise, and you know, and but at the same time, I made a lot of money, you know, because I was working in New York City, I was getting bonuses every year. So when I went into the art world, I wasn't like a kid coming out of college going into the art world where I was broke. I actually kind of went into the art world with a nice chunk of change. I had owned an apartment, I sold it. So, you know, I've always thought, I mean, now I'm kind of like, you know what, I got to start painting things that are people really want to buy and put in their house. But before then, I was always like, you know what, fuck it. I'm just gonna paint really what I want. I still do that because even when I paint, like lately, I've been trying to paint stuff with like women involved. I've been kind of not painting children. I've been trying to paint like women because my wife's like, paint women, will you? Everybody else is doing it, just do it. I'm like, all right, fine, I'll paint women, but it's under my rules, you know? So now I've been doing these women paintings, but they still have like a wry twist to them. There was a show recently where they wanted to do it, was supposed to be a product placement show. And I don't know if you remember if that piece you saw that go by on Facebook or something, but it was a woman. I literally got the image from like an old Woman's Day magazine from like the 50s. And it was this girl kind of looking very like housewifey, and she's putting a gun to her head, and the blast coming out is just a collage of different advertisements from back then, like Hunt's tomato ketchup and the weirder older products, but they were just like an amalgamation of like her brains were the products blowing out. But I was like, see, okay, I painted a pretty woman, but she was doing something
It's
horrible.
still dark, right?
Yeah.
But also, that's a delicious commentary.
Yeah, so it's, I don't want to let go of those, the underbelly of it. I'm not ready to just do a straight on, Clint kind of pretty woman.
Well, not only for that reason, but would you feel like if you did go in such a pretty avenue that you would be losing some of your energy and your enthusiasm for it? Or would you be
But
able to just be technically skilled?
yeah, I mean, I'm working on a project now that is it's really different. It's kind of like a homage to those 60s shows and stuff like Dragnet and stuff like that. And I'm doing some paintings in that aspect that are not dark at all. But what I'm trying to focus on is just the doing a focal point on little minor characters on these old TV shows and stuff. And it has nothing to do with anything wry or horrible, or I'm not trying to make a point about anything really. I don't know. It's just something different. And I don't love doing it. It's not as much fun for me. But I thought I'd try it out, see what happens.
Cool. I hope
So
it goes
I
well.
haven't finished them yet. I've only done about three of them. I'm gonna put them all together and see if somebody wants to show them somewhere or
Yeah.
something. But yeah, it's more fun to do, things that are gonna get people riled up, and I don't know, it's tough. It's like telling some old person you can't drive anymore,
Yep. So what are you gonna do?
Right.
So you already mentioned that you went to school for theater, but where did you go to school?
I went to the University of Bridgeport, which by the time I graduated, they sold to the Moonies, 51% to the Moonies. I don't know what happened to them now. They changed a lot. They just have an awesome theater and film program. And the theater people at the time who taught there was a woman named Phoebe Brand who was part of the group theater. And if you know anything about the theater, it's like Illy Kazan's group and that whole Morris Karnofsky, and they were all like really bigwigs, Clifford Odets. They all studied together, they all worked together. And so that was a real, I mean, when I eventually graduated from that, when I went to New York City, I studied with some people based on that because they were like, oh, I know Phoebe Brand. And so it was definitely, clout back then. The theater department was really good. And then when that happened, I think now they're more like a nursing school or something, So if I were to walk into a Chelsea gallery, they'd be like, where did you study? There's no art thing related to that,
Right.
but which was kind of too bad because one of the questions you have later is, what would you tell? Recommend to artists, and it's tough because, some people say, oh, you don't need to study art, but then when you start getting into the art world, you realize, well, a lot of these like galleries won't take you seriously if you haven't studied at California, whatever, what's the school there,
Caltech.
Caltech or one of the, and they get, oh, they want to know who you studied with, if you've had critiques, if you who you critiqued with. And they do want you to go to grad school, they want to know that you're serious. So that's the only thing I almost thought about it. I almost thought, oh, maybe I should just go back and get a graduate degree in art, just so I can kind of have one more feather in my cap. Because I mean, at one point I got a review in one of my shows from 2010. I actually got an art news review, and that was great. I was like super psyched. I was like, oh my God, my career is gonna blow up. I'm in art news. Look at that! It's a whole like a review of my show, and nothing happened. And I was like, oh, okay. So you can have a review of a show in like a major art magazine, and galleries still don't call you. I was like my naivete back then, but
Well, I think it also does highlight a degree of elitism and, name dropping that is again tied to this like the capitalism side of art, right? Where it's both the vetting, but it's also, yeah, the okay, I'm not going to get to know you, but where have you hit the points that we want to see people hit?
Yeah, it's always the people after they're long dead where they go, oh yeah, they never studied art and their paintings are selling for millions and Christie's
And they
and
saw none of it. Well, where would you say some of your technical skills have been developed? Because you do have, I certainly there is a strong evidence of eye for composition and color, like you were saying, through what you learned from interior design and stuff like that. But if it wasn't in school, where were some of the influences you looked towards for maybe the technical side of it?
that's a good question. I think a lot of it are, it's almost kind of like, I mentioned earlier my wife had a seizure and watching her trying to put her brain back together. I think a lot of it with my art technique, when I look back on it, it's been pieces of things that I think I've picked up. Like I remember an art teacher saying once, or somebody saying once, oh, you never paint exactly what you're looking at. You paint the shadows. So you're not painting an eye, you're painting a curve that's black. What that has, and even though it looks like the craziest thing, doesn't make any sense. When you finish that and step back, it will be an eye. So I've learned kind of like little snippets like that, and a lot of it's trial and error. I've blown a couple things. One thing I've learned, getting back to what would you tell an artist, is learn archival shit. Dude, I don't know how many times I've done something and I look back on it and it's yellow, or you're like, oh no. Prior to myself doing like paintings and this and that, I had years and years and years of being a drunk kid in New York City filling up sketchbooks, like 20 of them, all black ink. I used to do a lot of black ink drawings, pointism. I was into that for a while. And then again, learning about shadows and techniques, doing pointism. I look back on some of those old journals and they're all the inks all bled, turned yellow and whatever. And then even other stuff like, I used to frame my own works. I don't do that anymore because it was fun framing. I used to buy old frames and paint them and do them. But then I got a couple back recently from my hot wall show, and the spacers I used popped out, and it just looked, I'm like, oh, the paper's, I should have done something different because now the paper's rippling and it looks like shit. And so that's another thing I had to learn. I had to learn how to make things so they don't, they last. Because what's the point? You do these things and they're gone in 10, 15 years.
And for our listeners, some things to pay attention to when you are thinking, what is this archival shit of which Mike speaks? It's paying attention to using acid-free papers, lignin-free papers, using adhesives that are archival in nature. Yeah, just being, and what's so interesting is that actually that's something, and that's a conversation we often have in the museum, which is that, a lot of artists coming right out of school are broke, and or not out of school, whatever, they're broke, and so they're buying cheap paper for their sketches and stuff like that. And so one of my greatest joys about Charles Birchfield's archive is that I don't know if it was a combination of he was young and making a bunch of sketches at a time before the paper industrialization had gotten to the point where they were putting so much acid in it that I don't know if that was accessible to him when he was young in like 1918 and sketching a lot and painting a lot, but or if he just was always aware of the importance of buying good paper. But even his most throwaway sketches are on really beautiful paper. It's still newsprint. It's still like it's still light and flimsy, but it's not brittle and it's not yellow at this page. And it's why we are able to celebrate his archive 100 years
And then,
later.
you're gonna have the people who say, "So what?
And they're
I
going to
don't
be the people,
care. Doesn't last, doesn't last. I'm an artist."
and exactly, and there is
Pay
also
what I
that
want.
school
I
of
don't know what I
thought,
want.
right? There's that school of thought that it is the artist's job to create the work, and it is the museum's job to preserve the work, right? But if it
It's
doesn't
nice to
even,
have it help you out a little
right? And plus, also, if
bit.
it is purchased by a private collector and passed down a couple generations, and then gets to the museum, then it's, screwed.
That's like, well, it's funny. When my mother passed away, she left me an inheritance, and I always wanted to, getting back to, influences as a kid, I always liked growing up with art crumb. So I said, I've always wanted to own an art crumb placemat drawing. So I actually bought one, And it's an original stuff, but it's got like shit stains all over it. And I was thinking, oh man, you know what? I wonder if this thing will even be around in 10 years. It's like, at the end of the day, it's on some like diner placemat, you know?
Yeah.
But I think in that case, it's okay because that's, it is what it is. You know, the whole joy of that is it was done in the moment on a piece of cardboard or a piece of napkin or something.
Yeah.
So there's exceptions.
Yeah, I completely agree.
You just got to hope they last.
Right. Or that you have a good digitization plan.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is where I come in. Cool.
Which I don't have.
Yeah. We can talk. So, both within the art world and beyond it, you mentioned theater, but what are some of your other most important influences, whether as people or concepts or, you know, things you've engaged in?
You know, I mentioned Art Crumb, and then over the years, you know, other things like, I remember growing up as a kid, because when I grew up in the 60s, I'm, you know, 50 now. Mm-hmm. When I was born in 65, and a lot of the publications, the graphics out were like Dynamite Magazine. Have you ever seen an old, I don't know how old you are, but if you remember Dynamite, have you ever seen a Dynamite Magazine? They were very colorful 60s, yellow submarine-ish. All those colors were everywhere. So I've always had an affinity towards like pop colors. So that's kind of filtered into my work, and I like color. Although some of my most successful paintings were black and white ink works, excuse me, that I did back in like 2007, 2008, which kind of really launched me, you know. And those were based on another time frame where I fell in love with Edward Gorey's work, you know. So those were kind of reflective of the wry, dark, I say wry a lot, haven't I, in this interview? I can't think of what's another word for wry. But, you know, so his work has influenced me. And then now, as I get older, because I also collect art too, I collect photography. So I started with that back in New York. A lot of, mostly black and white. Lately, I've been doing some color stuff. And I always liked photography more than paintings because they were more emotional. You can capture an emotion more so in a photograph, I think, sometimes than in a painting. But I know people would argue that, and that's fine. But, oh, I'm sorry. So I was collecting photography, and then I started collecting a lot of pop art that was kind of out, like Shepard Fairey and, you know, Mark Ryden and stuff like that. And now, as I get older, I don't know what it is, if it's just a maturing thing, but my interest is not necessarily, it's more into like Robert Motherwell kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And Ellsworth Kelly, really minimal. And I think as you get older, you realize, oh my God, I'm going through this universe, I've collected so much crap, like a meteorite. I just want to, as I get older, I want less stuff.
Simplified.
You know, so I find that, oh, it's kind of weird. You know, the lavish paintings and stuff don't interest me as much as really simple stuff and elegant. Maybe that goes back to my interior design days, you know?
Or maybe it's that you needed the decades of accumulation, both of design and style and things, to help influence your feelings now with where you are about minimalism.
Right.
Know?
So now it's kind of funny. It's like I went from doing, you know, these lavish paintings of these like paisley backgrounds or like almost like wallpaper kind of funky colored backgrounds to like, I fell in love with, lately, painting on old ephemera, speaking of things that are going to last, I fell in love with taking old book covers and doing tongue-in-cheek kind of paintings that go with the titles.
I was looking at some of those on your website, and I love that you photograph it beforehand, too, so you see what the original was.
Right, so cause sometimes, yeah, because sometimes, you know, there's, I like that one of it's a Dynamite Magazine, getting back to that. It has Robin Williams. The original cover was Robin Williams and some chef.
Uh-huh.
And then I erased the chef and everything, and I had Robin Williams with these two like S&M leather characters.
Mm-hmm. I saw that.
I try to photorealistically render it. So if anybody really looked at that, they'd be like, wait, that couldn't have, what was the original cover? So I realized, oh, you know what? I should keep the original cover and so I can compare. So then I started getting into that, and that's been, like I said, getting back to what a problem with my work is that it's never, I don't paint the same painting all the time. Mm-hmm. So you would almost have to have, like, years from now, after I'm long dead, if I ever get on the Antiques Roadshow or anything, it's going to have to be a person who's really good at knowing, oh, this guy is the same guy who did this, because the through line is his humor, and because otherwise, the only thing that connects all my work is a sense of humor. Because I don't paint the same thing over and over.
Do you sign and date all your work?
Yeah.
Good.
Good. Yeah. I want to kill. I'm not going to say who it was. Somebody local here, I bought one of his paintings. And I got home and it wasn't signed. And I called him. I go, you idiot, don't you sign your work? He's like, oh, I'll call me. I'll sign it. Like, knucklehead.
That is, yeah, and that is a big.
It drives me crazy.
It drives us crazy too, and it certainly becomes problematic. Like there was a painting that was up for sale that we were pretty sure it was WPA era. This beautiful visionary view of Buffalo and the waterfront, and this sort of like the Queen of the Lakes and all these things, and no signature. Trying to figure out who did it, and we're pretty sure, you know, we narrowed it down to three different artists, but it was literally me and the curatorial staff going through different examples of these artists' work, being like, is this one, it could maybe be this one, you know, all these things, and it does a discredit to the artist's legacy.
Right. It does a real discredit to the collector, because I don't know how many times, if you do watch Antique Roadshow, these guys will say, well, if this is a so-and-so Winfrey painting, it'd be worth $50,000, and if it isn't, then maybe
$8,000. Have you seen that sort of documentary? What is it? Who the Fuck is Jackson Pollock?
Oh yeah, I love that movie.
I love that movie. It's so good.
My two favorite movies to watch, Double Bill, is that, and My Kid Could Paint That.
I've never seen that one.
That's a great one too. They're both so nasty. So you really get a sense of like it's a great moment of eye rolling art world filmmaking.
Yeah, absolutely. And then what was it? The director of the Met. At the time, I think, right. Or maybe it was MoMA, I don't remember, comes in and looks at the piece, right?
I love that guy.
And he's sitting there, and then he goes up to it, and he's looking at it. And I think, it does, like, it both builds up the mystique of the connoisseur, but at the same time, kind of knocks it down at the same time, where it's just like, okay, but what are you really doing here, you know? And
I wanted to, maybe I shouldn't tell anybody, I'll steal my idea, but I always wanted to have a reality show based on, like, My Kid Could Paint That, where you say, you know what? Because, you know, people always say, they look at somebody's artwork and they're like, what the hell? I could do that. Well, I thought it'd be kind of a cool reality show for some guys to try to recreate somebody's painting.
And then see. And then get the connoisseurs in and see if they can tell the difference.
Right. Well, so I think that it's kind of, that guy kind of does that in that Vermeer movie. Mm-hmm. That show, he kind of paints a Vermeer. But I was just thinking of doing, like, you know, if somebody is like a sculptural artist, it's like, okay, how, you know, without telling the people how he did it, try to figure out just by looking at it how this was made and see if you can redo it.
That'd be kind of cool. That should be part of public education. Or it's like, oh yeah, you think this is so easy? Do it.
Like, I'd like to see somebody try to do one of my paintings to see how it comes out. Or they could probably do it. I mean,
I'm
not doing anything amazing.
No, and certainly somebody with a certain level of technical skill might be able to mimic your style, but you have a wonderful sense of execution that really comes out in all your work. And there is a technical skill that's very obvious in your pieces that I really like about them.
Thank you.
Yeah. But color smashes on a wall. We have a Robert Flock piece at the end of the hallway in the archives corridor right now that is definitely the one that people walk up to and they're like, look at it, it's just a bunch of colors, you know, and we're like, And Bill mentioned, actually, our buildings and grounds manager said something really well, very well about sort of that mentality. He's like, you know what? Maybe you could have done this, but it's too late. It's already been done. Somebody already did it. And so it's not going to have the same impact, you know, by you doing it again. It's not just about the piece. It's also about the historical context.
Yeah.
In many ways. So you kind of touched on this in all sorts of different ways, but do you want to talk about your art and what you create and why you create it? I feel like that's been sort of like a theme throughout the interview thus far, but if there's more you'd like to...
I hope whoever's listening has gotten from me already that it... I don't know, I just like to paint things that people aren't expecting. I mean, that's kind of what it comes down to, you know. And I like to make them entertaining, visually entertaining, and it's tough because I always say funny art is a tough sell. Nobody, at the end of the day, when you go to a Christie's auction and, you know, millions are being spent, no one's going to spend $100 million on a funny painting. You know, they say most, the white girls in a white dress, they sell for the most. Mm-hmm. Everybody wants a girl in a white dress, you know. And then, you know, I wonder, like, an R. Crumb, what if his stuff would ever sell for, like, hundreds of thousands of dollars one day, because they're gross. Mm-hmm. You know, they're weird.
They're crass,
you know.
Yeah.
And I don't know. Can you think of any funny artists that sell big? But then again, it's kind of funny because some like historian will say, oh, look at this Rembrandt. It's hysterical. And you're like, I don't know. What do you mean? What's so funny about it? And they'll be like, oh, the priest is blah, 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 this.
I was like, okay,
back then, that would have been like an insult or something, you know.
I mean, I think Banksy's the one who's...
Right. And that's a good point. Yeah. Right. So I kind of like that.
Absolutely.
You know, I like to be, I don't want to be Banksy, but I do like him. I'm a little tired of him, but I like
think,
him.
I also think he's played the art market, you know, rather than letting it play him in this way. And I think that also the prices of his works is also capitalizing on the mystique, you know, that he has created. And also, like, Exit Through the Gift Shop is the most intense
mindfuck
of a parody. Yeah. You know, I mean, it takes you a couple times to watch it of realizing, like, what the actual point is, you know, just making fun of the art world.
I still don't even know if that is Banksy.
Right.
In the interview. I don't even know if that's a fake.
Right.
I don't know if the whole thing is a fake.
Right.
It's a good movie. My only criticism of Banksy now is that I feel like, okay, dude, I get it. You're cynical.
Mm-hmm.
I get you're sarcastic. You're sarcastic. I get it. You don't Disneyland. Yeah, okay, you don't like Disneyland. I get it.
Right.
It's like, I like to see him just do something else. I don't know what. I don't know what I'd expect him to do. But
well, and also he's, in some ways, I wonder if he has pigeonholed himself, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where people don't want to see happy art from him, right? They would be very intensely critical. Certainly his, I agree with a lot of his politics, especially early on, and like what he did when he went to Gaza and stuff like that. And those are just like punches to the gut, you know, that were beautifully executed, incredibly difficult to even get there to do it, and then just so poignant. But yeah, I think he's in some ways maybe been a victim of his own success.
Yeah.
Certainly.
Hey, if I had a product that people drank up, I'd be kind of... I understand why when I said I don't paint the same thing over and over. And I totally get why some of my art contemporaries that I show with and work with and stuff, a lot of them do paint the same thing basically over and over and over, but they're making tons of money at it. You know, I just would be bored with that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people always say to me, you should do a comic book. When I used to do Inkworks. And I'd be like, yeah, but... I would do about a page and a half of comics, and I'd be bored. I'd be like, I can't draw this fucking kid over and over and over for 55 times.
Yep.
You know, I drew him once already, okay? I got, you know, I'd rather just do, if I could do like a one-frame comic, like a, what's his name?
Like a Lichtenstein.
Yeah. You know, that I could do. I couldn't do a whole comic book, you know?
And certainly when you were talking about your art teacher who, you know, helped you break down form into shapes, that made me think of Lichtenstein's process where, you know, he would take the comic strip and he would turn it upside down and paint that.
You're not painting what you're seeing.
Right, you're painting what's there. And so that's what kind of allowed him to get away from...
But I think I also learned that from that old-fashioned technique, the grid painting,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
where you paint each box, and in that box, no matter what it looks like, you just paint it.
Yep.
Because it's going to end up...
Yeah, and that's a very historical... framework there and the camera obscura and all these different ways of rendering. Yeah. So you were mentioning how it would be hard to see the linear progression of your work, but it also sounds like you work in a serial nature, right? Where you work on you have a different period or you have a different series that you're working
it's
on.
It's turning out to be that way. I mean, you know, I don't know the blue boy, what's his name's period, the blue period. I don't know how long that lasted. I don't know if a period is supposed to last like 10 years or if a period could last 2 years or 1 year. You know, my periods seem to be much shorter. You know, like I did the black and white Inkworks from about like 2005 to like 7 or 8. Then I started doing the poppy portraits of the kids, and I did those for about 3 years. And then I started doing some book paintings, and I started working on those for about a year. You know, so I kind of jump around. I also, you know, I made a declaration on Facebook a while ago saying I'm not going to paint kids anymore. And I think people are like, oh.
Because you managed to take, you know, the way you render children is both beautiful and sweet and dark. And it's like, that's just such a sweet spot that I think a lot of people who do like that funny but pointed, you know, art. It's just, I mean, they're a perfect medium for that, you know. But even children's books as well plays with that and ties into it.
Yeah, it always kind of bothers me too. And I understand it all. And I always hated when, like, I feel as a collector, you should buy a person's work throughout their career.
Mm-hmm.
But then I get it if you don't like their work and you don't buy it. So, you know, you lose collectors, you gain collectors, but I try not to lose anybody. I try to say, like, listen, just stick with me a little bit longer. Just see where this goes,
mm-hmm.
you know. That's my hope, is that, you know, if I have any kind of fan base, they don't completely give up on me. They just kind of see where it all goes.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
And certainly that's a sign to me of a curious nature. You know, like, you seem into it so long as you're excited by it, and then when there's not something else for you to pick apart there, you move on to something else.
Yeah, exactly.
And that, you know, an inquisitive nature, I think, is more important than almost anything.
It's a hard commodity. You know, it's hard to sell that.
Charlie Birchfield dealt with that a lot. And I mean, I talk about Charlie like he's like my best friend, and you know, he's been dead since my mother was five. But when he was young, making these really, you know, right out of art school, was heralded as just like a master of design and all these things. But he was making these, maybe he's still in art school, but he was making these very abstract landscapes in this way, with sort of, you know, windows of houses that almost look like eyes, and just like feeling this, a lot of emotional embodiment in these sort of picking apart and putting back together the world you see around you, you know. And then mid-career, he started doing these very realistic landscapes, you know, and that's when you see like Rainy Night, which is the painting of the Perks building downtown next to the library, you know, this very almost Hopper-esque night urban street scene. And that's when he really started being successful and was represented in New York and was able to like support his family throughout the Great Depression, you know, even through all of that. And then later in life, once he's sort of really established himself, then he goes back to these almost like hallucinogenic landscapes
right.
that he did. And everyone who loved his realistic urban setting paintings
turned off
and like, what are you doing? You know, what's with these massive, you know?
And that's the question. Do you say F you? I'm an artist.
I can't imagine Charlie saying F you, but he probably should have at certain points, and certainly was unapologetic and didn't back down.
Yeah.
I mean, to be very simplistic about all of it, but you know, he knew what he wanted and knew what he wanted to get back to, and sort of used the foundation of his reputation at that point to say, yeah, I know I can do it that way, but I want to look for something deeper.
I always feel, you know, every artist is like a firework. You know, it's kind of like it lights off, it shoots up, you get what you get, it fizzles out, and it's over.
Yeah.
You know, so that's it.
And sometimes you get lots of little different pops, you know?
Yeah,
and sometimes,
yeah, yeah.
Sometimes it's all over the place and it's different things. I certainly love like AJ's work as an example of all the different places an artist can go. You know, he goes from these super sumptuous, colorful dessert and sex toy paintings to now these very mature and somber grayscale works of the soap bubbles in the bottom of the sink. And
right.
just being
right.
able to see the breadth that he's gone with a lot of things is,
right.
I think it shows you that, you know, there's a lot of artists are not one trick ponies.
And I forget too sometimes, like when you just mentioned period, there was a time when I was being an artist, not even being an artist. Like I have probably about a decade's worth of sketchbooks that pretty much that's all I did was just black ink sketchbook paintings. So I mean, that's a whole time period before I started really selling my art.
Well, which is why those are possible donations for the archive someday.
Yeah,
you know, like that's also an important component to be aware of. And then there are artists like Tom Holt, you know, who his main mode of art creation and display is the sketchbooks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so how does that make it more difficult?
And the funny thing is, I have not drawn in the sketchbook for years, mm-hmm. since I've been doing like full-blown paintings.
Mm-hmm.
I know some people, I'll draw out a painting maybe how I want it, but it's like stick figures.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I know I want the kid here, I want the thing here, I want this here.
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of miss that, you know. But that was also part of a lifestyle. Like I lived in New York City, I was walking around everywhere, I'd bar hop. Be stoned, about mushrooms, or whatever the hell I was doing.
You would
know,
be the
just
creative torture.
Kind of, torture, yeah, you know.
Sketchbook on a
drawing for
night.
Women.
Yeah.
You know, I used to pick
oh,
up
yeah.
so many girls at bar, drawing a napkin. Hey, look at that, baby.
Yeah, absolutely. It still works.
It doesn't work anymore.
No, you know.
Now that I'm married. Yeah.
Nice ring on your finger.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, talking about the totality of your body of work, like we mentioned humor, we mentioned this like this wry, almost macabre quality to it, but what are some of the underlying themes you either see in your work as a whole or in different periods?
Oh, yeah, I mean, you know, I've always, you know, I loved contradiction. I like, you know, putting humor in, you know, but, you know, when I did the Youth Parade series, it was, you know, kids with guns, it was... I remember hearing a story on NPR talking about how there were two kinds of kids that go to college. When they get to college, there's Crispies and China Cups.
Mm.
And the Crispies were kids who were already burned out before they get to college. Their parents had them doing a million things, and they get to college and they're just burned out. They don't want, you know. And then the China Cups were kids who were so coddled that they got to college and they couldn't take it. They just kind of. And then there was like a whole story about New York City. A lot of Asian kids just jumping to their deaths in the library. They had a rash of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did a whole show about pressures in society for kids. One was a girl in a college graduate outfit, NYU, and she's holding her arms and you see she's like a cutter,
mm-hmm.
you know. So it was kind of like, and that's the show that really kind of put a dip in my, because I, when I first started out, I was like doing these, you know, Edward Gorey-esque kind of things, and people loved them. They were cute. So I had a sold-out show, my first show in Los Angeles. Second show sold out. Third show, what happened was my father died, and then I got kind of serious, and then I started doing that youth parade, and that was like, okay, so a little less. Mm-hmm. And then
you
I said a little less, a little less, a little less.
You know what's interesting, too, about that is, you know, you mentioned that, like funny art doesn't sell at Christie's, right? But at a show, funny art sells, you know, and maybe that serious stuff is...
Yeah, well, that was also, too, I mean, you know, I'm lucky. I have a gallery out in Los Angeles who, you know, even through all the years, you know, they gave me solo shows, but as the time went on and my work got a little wackier and darker, they kind of pulled back, but they still show my work. But and so thank God they've stuck with me, you know. But, yeah, Los Angeles... They like my work a lot because it's colorful and it's dark. And, you know, the funny thing is, in Los Angeles, they have an air of being very happy, but they love horrible things happening to people because they can't say it.
You can be like, oh, look at it on the wall.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, meet me for lunch. Let's do lunch. You know, they never plan on ever doing it. So I think my work always kind of rang true to them because they're like, you know.
Does your work sell better in L.A. than New York?
Yeah.
Does your work sell... I mean, well, actually, I know the answer.
Because in L.A., my work is... I think in Los Angeles, like I said, they enjoy that kind of, like, it's poppy, it's colorful. It has that whole sense of, like, look, it's all happy, but when you really look at it, it's like, oh, that's horrible. You know, that's perfect. That's L.A. in a nutshell. You know, it looks like it's a great place. You get there, you're like, oh, my God, it's horrible. Especially in the film industry, you know. But in New York City, I think my work just comes across as goofy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of like... silly.
And what sort of reception have you gotten in Buffalo?
Oh, pretty good. It's been tough because I haven't really ever had a chance to sit and work on a show for Buffalo. You know, it's kind of like I've always been having to do something for a show in Los Angeles, or I have a gallery in New York that used to show my work. They're kind of changing their scope or something. They're doing something totally different now. But so I did the Hall Wall show, but that was like almost like a mini retrospect of stuff that I had gotten back from the gallery and this and that. So that was a nice introduction to people in Buffalo of like what I do. But I just haven't done a show here because I know people don't, I don't think they want to spend a lot of money in Buffalo. I don't think I would make any money doing a whole, and that's kind of the whole thing. I could do a show in Buffalo, but I probably wouldn't sell anything.
And that is often the challenge that a lot of artists are dealing with.
Let's put it this way. In my Hall Wall show, I didn't sell a single piece. John Massey, actually, he sort of would have bought one. I think he just bought it because he wanted to have a piece of mine.
Well, what about Echo? You know, what about, which is a local, you know. I know you know what it is.
Yeah, no, yeah. I, you know, it's funny. I have like a kind of, I don't like to pay to play. Mm-hmm. I've always hanging out. So, I, you know, I did the first year. I paid the money. I sent my thing in and I didn't get in. And I was like, I'm not going to do that again.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I just don't. But I think it's cool. I go to every year to it, and people sell their work and stuff. And maybe I would do it once. I know, what's her name is selling my work, Jinxie,
mm-hmm.
through Benjamin Gallery. Mm-hmm. And maybe she'll have some of my work at Echo. So I might get into Echo through the back door that way, through a gallery. But as a single artist, I've never done pay-to-play. I mean, even like those illustration week monthlies or bi-monthlies they do, you got to pay like 60, you know, 8x8. All those other Spectrum, whatever they are, you got to pay like $100, $125 just to have your work seen. I always think that's kind of shitty.
Right.
I know the magazines, they're trying to make money and whatever.
Right. And they're trying to keep themselves alive. And I totally agree with you. But it also for like, you know, more emerging artists in some ways, it's like, okay, how do you get your work out there?
Well, I'll tell you, the best way to do it is, the way I did it was through fundraising.
Uh-huh.
If you're just trying to get your work out, I used to just, any kind of group show that they were doing for freebies, it's kind of funny, I got... Morgan Spurlock got wind of me somehow, and my friend Lori works with him, so he had me do something he was raising money for a school in Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
And I gave him a piece for that, and it sold pretty well. And then he asked me again recently to do something for that Paddle 8 website.
Mm-hmm.
So I submitted something to that, and you know, it helps, you know, especially if a gallery is doing like a fundraising event, and like that thing Julian put together in New York City. Somebody from that saying, you know, I really like that piece, and people bid it up really high, and who is this artist? Let me look them up, you know. So.
And that's something I think a lot about, which is like that model, you know, you say you don't pay to play, but in some way that's another, you know.
You're paying, you're giving up a piece of work.
Right.
But there's something more admirable about saying, you know what, I'm going to donate this work in hopes that it furthers my career as opposed to giving some money to some guy I don't even know.
Right.
And
absolutely.
He's going to judge me and keep the money. And,
right. Well, it just speaks back to like wealth inequality even in the arts, right? That some paintings are being sold for such extraordinary amounts of money. And then on the other side of it too, galleries which are trying to support artists are also asking artists to donate to support them in that way. And it's something we do as well. You know, we have an auction every year. And it has been great for people's careers, and it's been very good for us. And it builds, I think what's really nice too about the Birchfield, because we are a regional arts museum, it does build camaraderie. You know, it builds that relationship with individuals with the museum, which can sometimes feel like too big of an institution to actually connect with. And at other times it's like, oh, actually, no, it's the people I'm connecting with. But then the other side of it is, too, is I'm like, okay, if we're here to promote their work, but we're actually also asking something of them, but I guess that's the trade-off.
And also, too, that you have to kind of, like, figure it out. Like, with the Hall Walls, the draw show, I did, like, the first two and three, and my work sold really a lot the first one, kind of a lot the second one, and then not so much, really low the third time, and I was like, you know what?
Step away.
Take a break now, because it's like...
Let somebody else step in.
Yeah, it's like, you know, maybe they get a little tired of me. I'll show up again in a couple of years or something.
And everyone be like, oh, there he is again. Yeah. Oh, I loved what you did a work with bees, right?
Yeah,
I love that.
So
it was really good.
But then the third time, one piece sold for $100. I'm like, you know what? I just busted my ass for 45 minutes. That thing only sold for $100. It's like, you know what? I'll see.
Right.
You know, so I told John I would do it this February, but because I just feel like I have to do something because we've had such bad year this year.
Right. Well, so let's end on this question because I feel like a lot of the other things we've touched on already, but what do you hope to achieve with your art? I know that's a big, broad, conceptual thing, but...
I always say I hope I can get on Antiques Roadshow one day. That's my ultimate plan.
Right.
Whether I'm around... I know I can't be around, that's for sure. Although, has Antiques Roadshow ever done anybody who's alive? I don't know. They've ever had an artist still alive on, but usually they're long gone.
They're normally gone. Not always, but...
I think my ultimate plan is for somebody to... Like, if they were doing a retrospective of my work somewhere, like in 30 years or 50 years or something, I would think people could say, like, wow, he did a large body of work and it was all pretty good. You know what I mean? It was all, like, thought out. I would love to have all my work look back on and say, wow, that was all pretty well thought out. I'd love to people say there was no real shitty piece he did. Or even his crappiest piece is actually not too bad.
Yeah. All right. That is Don Metz, who is our public programming director here at the museum, once gave me and a friend the best advice I think I've ever gotten. He said, have reasonable dreams.
Mm-hmm.
Have achievable dreams. And that sounds like a very reasonable dream.
Because I'll tell you the truth, it's hard for me to do a bullshit piece. Like, even when I don't want to do something, and if I have to do, like, say, a fundraising piece, I promise somebody I would do something, even when it comes down to the wire, it's like, you know what? I can't just do some bullshit thing. I got to work on something decent. And that goes back, and I learned that lesson years and years and years ago. This woman, when I used to do my ink drawings in the sketchbook, this girl liked my work a lot. And she wanted me to do something for her boyfriend for his birthday. And I never did it. And then the day came. She's like, oh, do you have the piece? And I was like, oh, my God. I never did it. So I just kind of pulled one from a sketchbook. And I lied and said, I did that for him. And I could tell she knew I was full of shit. Because it had really nothing to do with him or anything. I kind of talked my way around it. And then I felt so bad. I felt so guilty and dirty and terrible. I said, man, you know what? I'm never going to do that again. I learned a lesson. It's funny. And thank God it was like a little social thing, and it wasn't like, you know, like an institution or something. But I learned my lesson from it, you know. So now I never really try to do anything like just
half-assed.
Yeah.
Well, is there anything you'd like to say before we conclude?
I just want to say thank you for including me.
I'm so pleased. This was a wonderful interview. The time actually really felt like it was flying by.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I could probably talk yap, but she's been sitting in the car for an hour and 20
totally
minutes.
So, but thank you so much for coming in today, and we hope to see you soon at the Birchfield.